It was a very strange transition going from heli to airplane, and I guess really I was just too gentle is the best way to put it at first.
Hey everyone, it's Ryan here with Cardinal Aviation. Welcome to episode number 44 of the Audio Briefings. Thank you very much for joining us. We're really happy to have you. Before I do anything, I want to thank some show supporters. So as you know, you can go on our website, cardinalaviation.ca, and visit the podcast page. And there you can choose to support the podcast and to help us bring this content to you. And this week we have two new annual supporters. So I really want to thank Nathan in Ontario and Daniel in Dubai for becoming our latest annual subscribers. I really appreciate your support. Thank you so much. I also want to thank Gord Reed for buying the coffee this week. Again, really needed it and enjoyed the heck out of it. Got a great coffee maker here at home, so tend to make them at home just to help that contribution last a little bit longer, maybe get a couple of coffees out of it. But thank you guys for your support. And if that's something you're interested in doing, you can go on our website and either pick up some gear or support the podcast in other ways. So thank you again. Some interesting things that have happened this week. Finished a big ops manual for a client. That was a big job, to say the least, but really enjoyed the kind of technicalities and getting into the regs and building training plans and emergency response plans and safety management system plans. Again, a lot of computer work, but aviation related. We love it. Also did some quoting of some pretty interesting ferry flights on some larger airplanes, everything from Beech 1900s this week to a couple Cessna 170 jobs. So working with the clients there to see if we can help them out, or at least find somebody to help them out. Had some great responses to our session with Owen last week, and I have been going through some resumes and giving some feedback, but one thing that has come of that is Cardinal Aviation coach and consultant Blake Haché, who you've heard us talk about here before, is just putting together a program that we're going to have details out about in the next week or so, where you will be able to submit your resume to us, and Blake and a couple other people that are working with us are going to go through your resume, and they are going to reformat it, and they're going to make it look like $1 million. And for a small fee, we are going to work with you to make sure that you have absolutely the best resume to represent you as you go out in the job hunt. And this is something that Blake and a couple other pilots that are not working right now due to this COVID situation are putting together as a way, one, to help you, but also, again, they're networking, they're creating some work for themselves, being proactive, and they're looking for opportunities that they can get involved in during this time and help people at the same time. So looking forward to bringing you those details. In terms of this episode today, we are going to be talking to not one, but two guests. And this is the first time I've ever done a double interview where there's three people on, and I'm going to warn you right now, one of the microphones, George's mic, was a little bit interesting. There's a little bit of a tone in the background, so I've done my best to edit that out as much as I can, so I apologize in advance if that kind of gets to you a little bit. But we've got George and Sam Adams today, and both these guys are helicopter instructors, and they are both fixed wing pilots. Now George flies corporately a Piaggio 180, as well as probably at least a dozen different helicopter types. And he's a class one helicopter instructor and a commercial or an ATPL and obviously multi-IFR fixed wing pilot. Sam Adams, on the other hand, is my helicopter instructor, and he just this week finished converting his helicopter commercial to a fixed wing private and also wrote his instrument rating exam this week. So both these guys fly both airplanes and helicopters. I fly airplanes, and I'm working on learning how to fly helicopters. And in this conversation, we're going to talk about some of the similarities, some of the differences, a couple stories, and just really interesting to watch the two worlds of fixed wing and rotor kind of collide with three guys that are very passionate about both. So before we get into that, I just want to shout out both of their Instagrams, because that's how I got to know them over Instagram, and they are both phenomenal. Sam is at Hey Sam Adams. And if you want to hear more about Sam's story, and we'll mention it in the conversation, check out the Pilot to Pilot podcast, where Justin interviewed Sam, and you get Sam's whole backstory. It's fascinating. And George's Instagram is at Pad Tango, exactly as it sounds. And he's super active on there. Great stuff. I really enjoy seeing his content and what he has to post. So we had this conversation that you're about to hear. We recorded it, and the next morning after we recorded it, I went out and had a helicopter lesson. And it had been about 10 days since my last one. And Sam and I went up, and we did some circuits and some auto rotations in the infield at the airport. And then Sam got out and said, okay, go practice on your own for an hour. And I got to tell you, it was probably one of the worst flights I've had in a long time. It felt horrible. I couldn't string together a stable approach to save my life. It was one of those flights where the pilot becomes a passenger. And if you're a pilot and you have any self-awareness or pride whatsoever, the absolute worst feeling is when, rather than being in command of the machine, you've basically turned into a passenger and you're along for the ride. And it is not a great feeling. It's something that we need to recognize and be aware of, and then make changes of quickly. And without getting into details, I went out solo. Didn't start out so great. Got to the point where I pretty much told Sam, you know what, I'm done for the day. And that's a tough spot for an instructor, because you don't want to push somebody who says that, you know what, they're done. But in my case, I mean, Sam knows me at this point, and he said, you know what, I'm not letting you stop for the day. You're going to go out and do a few more. And we were able to string a few good ones, or I was able to string a few good ones together. And, you know, I guess left having definitely learned some lessons the hard way. But, you know, when you're training in anything, it is not all sun and roses. There are challenges. And with challenges, hopefully come triumphs. But I'm hoping my next session in a week or so is much better than the one I had the day after we recorded this. It was humbling, to say the least, but as you know, that's why I went down this road, to be humbled, to learn something new, and you know what, to suck at something. But after three solo sessions of feeling really, really good about myself, the next flight, the day after we recorded this, was not one of those, and I will take it and review it, and it'll be the last thing I think about every day before I go to bed, and the first thing I think about in the morning until I can go and do it again, but better. So without any further delay, and after that moment of honesty, I'm going to cut straight to my conversation with Sam and George. Here you go. Sam, George, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, same. It's awesome. Thank you for having us.
No worries. So George, why don't we start with you? So just before we started recording, you were about to tell us how you got into where you are now. So what's kind of the road you took to fly both airplanes and helicopters?
Yeah, well, I'll try to keep it relatively brief, but I grew up around airports and airplanes. My dad had a Mooney. He was a private fixed wing pilot, used it for business, and was involved in the Langley Airport back in the 70s. I grew up listening to stories about how the community wanted to shut down the airport, but that's a whole nother story. And as a kid, I was kind of fearful of flying. My brother bounced around the province quite a bit with my dad and subsequently got scared off of flying, and I was scared at a young age and didn't pick up the flying bug until I was a teen. And at the age of 16, started my flight training, and 17, became a private pilot. Did some, you know, personal flying, and probably none for business back then in the early years, and then took 12 years off as life caught up and business, family, children, homes, etc. And but once the flying bug hits you, it never leaves. And in the mid-2000s, I got back into it, went for a couple of refresher lessons. After two lessons, they said I was current. I didn't really feel very current, so carried on with my training. I guess I always enjoyed the training. I enjoyed learning, and that's a key foundation of what I do, is that I always can really enjoy continuing to learn. And so once I sort of got current again, as they said, it seemed like a good opportunity to continue my training. I did multi-engine, multi-IFR, and finally had the time and the money to pursue the helicopter license. So that was about 12 years ago, I guess, that I started the helicopter, and sort of stretched out my training. I did the license in 100 hours, but it was over the course of a year and a half or something like that. And then I leased a helicopter for a while and bought an R-44 and flew that for a few years. And I found I really enjoyed taking people for rides, explaining what I was doing, giving them a chance to fly, and teaching a little bit. So in 2014, I became a flight instructor, and currently I'm a Class 1 flight instructor at Chinook Helicopters in Abbotsford.
When we talked to Owen last episode, he told the story about his uncle or a friend of his told him, in aviation, make aviation your hobby and have a side gig that does something else. And I think you've mastered that.
Yeah, that's worked pretty well. And my wife's actually a pilot as well, and my daughter's done a little bit of training, but I say that I'm much better at moving life aside for aviation. So, yeah.
Awesome. And Sam, I listened to an awesome podcast that you did with on Pilot to Pilot, where you spent an hour talking about your story, and you've told me your story personally, and that is an incredible story on how you ended up in aviation. So, if you could tell us just kind of how you ended up in BC as a flight instructor. I want to send anybody who wants to hear the full story, the incredible story. I don't want to double it up, because unless you want to tell it again, because I want to talk airplanes and helicopters, but go to Pilot and listen to the Sam Adams episode. And, it's something else. So listen to that. But Sam, how did you end up in BC?
Yeah. So, I mean, the story that you're referencing is basically something that's, been with me since before I was even born. So it was always something that, kind of anchored, me. And, initially, I was always interested in aviation as a young kid. My dad was in the military, so we were around military bases a lot, got to go out to the flight line a lot. He was a flight surgeon, so he was always assigned to a squadron. So he flew with some helicopter squadrons in the Navy, and then he also flew with some F-15, F-16 squadrons in the Air Force. So I was always around that, and always was super interested in it, but never decided that it would be a career. I kind of decided to pursue other things, and was really heavily involved in the cable wakeboarding industry and building cable wakeboarding parks as a project engineer. And so I did that for about 10 years. And after doing it for 10 years and kind of getting a little bit burned out, I started to reference back to the story that you are referring to earlier, and was kind of thinking, you know what, maybe it's time to make a change and to finally go for, flying. And I figured, I'd eventually be able to do it privately on my own if the companies did well and the time and experience I built in that industry panned out the way I wanted it to. But it started to look like it might not be the case. So decided to just, just go for it, and started looking up places to learn to fly in Florida, which is where I'm from, and figured out pretty quick that Florida is not a great place to fly helicopters or learn, helicopter training. And came across Misha's videos of BC and figured, that is the best place to learn to fly in the world. And I believe that to this day. Like, there's not a better training ground for helicopters that I know of in the entire world. So made the move, came up here, and pitched an idea to Misha to film my entire commercial training from start to finish. So we filmed pretty much every single flight that I ever went on with him, and then almost every solo flight as well. And then he would edit the videos together. And at the time, I didn't really care about being on video or, you know, doing anything like that. I'm a little less into that now. I kind of like my privacy, kind of like George. And so I'm taking a little step back from that. But it was a really fun experience. And Misha has a huge following on YouTube. And I learned a lot from that. And then through that, I developed a really good relationship with Misha. And basically halfway through my training, he offered me a job. And I had like maybe 45, 50 hours. And I was like, well, that doesn't seem like a good idea. But so he offered me a job, and I worked for them commercially for a bit, and then got my hours up to become, you know, eligible to do the instructor rating, because it's quite high, 250 hours PIC, which is a lot.
That's just to start the training, right?
Yeah, considering you only get 36 minimum. Well, yeah, 36 minimum in the commercial license. So. Or is it 35? It's
35.
Yeah, 35 and is the PIC that you would get minimum out of the commercial license. You could obviously get more, but you know, to go from that to 250 takes quite a bit. So we did that, and I worked for them, did pipeline patrol and charters and that sort of thing. And then once I got my hours up and did the instructor rating, I started instructing full time. And now I'm just waiting to upgrade to class one, taking my test in a week and a half, and then I just got to do the rides. So it's been awesome, and so, I definitely couldn't be happier doing it in BC. I can't even imagine being back in Florida and having to flight instruct there, especially with how hot it's been the past few days. I'm dying.
You know, I grew up in BC. I learned to fly in BC, and this is home. And I think after a certain amount of time, we kind of take it for granted. And flying with you lately, you're just like, you're always like, this is freaking amazing. And it kind of, it's a really cool reminder to not take for granted what we have around us, especially when we spend our whole lives here. So being able to see it through your Everglades eyes.
No, I'm not from the Everglades. Well, I'm not from South Florida, but
same.
Yeah,
has been really cool. So, so you came up, you did your helicopter, you got a job. In all honesty, until you and I started chatting about helicopter, so I don't know how or why. I think it was because we have a mutual connection. But I had never seen one of your videos or one of Misha's videos until after we started talking, until after you wrote me into coming and doing an intro lesson. Which, by the way, we'll just get this out of the way right now. I booked an intro lesson with Sam, and then I've been chatting with George a whole bunch too, because I love his Instagram. And I said, yeah, I booked a lesson. He goes, come do one with me. And so I did a lesson with Sam, and then I went and did one with George. And it was super awkward for like 2 weeks. But anyway, the funny thing is with the cross-pollination there is there's two major helicopter schools in southwestern BC, or at Abbotsford, and there's BC Helicopters where Sam works, and there's Chinook Helicopters where George works, and they're the rivals and the competition at Abbotsford Airport. Funny enough though, Sam is doing Chinook Helicopters also does fixed wing, so Sam works at BC Helicopters, but he's doing his fixed wing conversion, or just finished it, at Chinook Helicopters. So everybody's kind of playing in everyone else's sandbox here a little bit. The waters have been muddied. But and Sam, you did, I just want to plug this, you did your PPL flight test yesterday, or day before
yesterday.
And then last night at like 11 texted me, and you're like, I'm going to do my instrument rating written tomorrow. And I'm like, you're freaking nuts. So
it was a poor choice, but transport's so booked. It was the only test I could get till mid-September. So I was like, if I'm going to get this done, I got to get it in. And luckily I passed. But yeah, it was a tough test. It wasn't easy. And, you know, the whole aspect of fixed wing is, and IFR is so much more structured than the type of flying I'm used to. So That is a steep learning curve for me.
Let's talk just the, without getting into IFR, the mechanics of going from fixed wing to heli or heli to fixed wing. George, what do you remember being like the transition being like from fixed wing to heli?
You know, it was interesting. I can remember the first helicopter ride I had, which I think was in the early 2000s. And I remember thinking in forward flight, you know, it flies like a very sensitive airplane because I had those skills, but I knew nothing about helicopters at the time. You know, looking at it now, I can tell that there's a few other nuances, but that's a pretty fair statement just for a fixed wing guy starting to fly a helicopter. And of course, when I first tried to hover on that non-official intro ride way back then, it was just a commercial guy who was able to take me for a ride. You know, his comment was, "Oh, you're going to embarrass yourself now," which of course we all do on that first hover moment. But of course, that was also a pretty good fish hook to get me interested in it. It was a number of years before I could fully engage and start the training. I think I was fortunate in that I didn't have a lot of fixed wing time when I went to helicopter, and therefore I didn't bring a whole bunch of habits that, you know, might have need to have been broken, etc. I was maybe better prepared to absorb the helicopter separately from the fixed wing side. And even to this day, somehow I don't find it difficult to sort of jump from one to the other. The brain does its thing and separates the two nicely somehow. So it'll be interesting to see how your experiences are, Ryan, as you go on. So.
You know what the funny thing is? I thought my airplane was broken to the point where I took it to MaxCraft to get my avionics checked, because in the last couple of months I've been flying so much different equipment, like everything from the Cabri helicopter with Sam to the TBM with a client to a Cirrus to my Bearhawk. And so I took my Bearhawk up to a strip up here, and I'm just like, my airspeed indicator is telling me one thing. It's like, yeah, you're approaching at 50, but I feel like I'm going freaking 90. And I'm just, this is like, something's broken here. My airspeed indicator is not right. I'm going way too fast to be landing here. And I hadn't flown the Bearhawk in several weeks, but I've been doing all this other stuff and flying heli. And, you know, we go out for a helicopter flight, we might do like 15 or 20 landings. And I called MaxCraft and I said, can you like do an airspeed calibration? And they're like, everything's fine. And then I realized that the helicopter flying has just completely screwed up my tailwheel flying, because tailwheel before, like approaching at, you know, 48 or 50 knots was nice and slow and I'd put it on my spot. But helicopter, by the time you touch down, like ideally you're doing what, anywhere from 5 to 0 knots. So my just mental perspective on what the approach, like the initial approach looks the same, but the last bit when you touch the ground is totally off. And I feel like it has completely ruined my fixed wing flying, at least in the on the slow speed end. It's definitely special. I mean, you guys, you talk about that hook. I've talked in previous episodes, I went and did the intro flight because I wanted a new challenge. I wanted to suck at something, which I absolutely did. And then you're like, you try the hover and you can't do it. And okay, well, I need to try it again. And by the time you get it, you're, I don't know, what, 7, 8 hours in before you can kind of do it consistently. And then at that point, you're, okay, well, now I can hover. And then one of you guys says, yeah, but you're only like 3 or 4 hours away from solo now. And then, okay, well, now I got to at least do that. And then you do that first solo flight, and you're like, okay, I have to do the whole thing now. There's no
I
other
have a
option.
saying that seems like it should be thrown at this moment, Ryan. I like to say that I've spent a lot of money on aviation in my life. The rest I've wasted.
True. True. Yep. I could not agree more. I was cutting a check here about an hour ago, and my wife came around the corner and said, "What's that?" And I folded it up and put it in my flight bag so that I could hand it over tomorrow when I get to the airport. But Sam, going the other way, what was your kind of first impression going from helicopter over to fixed wing?
I'm pretty happy with how things went for me as far as like being ab initio helicopter and having all of those really core foundations in place, because I've flown with a fair share of low time helicopter guys, like from the States that might have a private helicopter license but are, you know, 1,000 hour fixed wing guys. And yeah, there's definitely been some moments where I've been a little bit freaked out. And you read about the, you know, accident reports and the things that can happen from that experience gap there. And so I'm really happy that my foundation is Heli. It was a very strange transition going from Heli to Airplane. And I guess really I was just too gentle is the best way to put it at first. Like so gentle on the throttle, so gentle on the flight control inputs and the rudder pedals.
Air quotes, and, as you do air quotes.
Yeah, yeah. So just way too gentle. And that moment was a huge, you know, I had realized this previously in training fixed wing guys how to fly helicopters, but it wasn't until I really got my hands and feet on the controls and realized how much control input you need in some situations to keep it, you know, under control. And if you were to do that in a helicopter, I mean, you're just asking for, you know, trouble. So it was really strange to actually, you know, start to be more aggressive on the controls, if that is a okay way to put it.
After your first fixed wing lesson, I took you up in the Bearhawk because you had mentioned that. And I said, okay, you fly and you're being all like gentle and ginger. And I said, no, just crank it.
Yeah.
Just exactly. Just go for it. You're like, we can't do that. I said, no, just do it. And you were talking about, you're like, well, like we're up over like a big lake and you're like, I feel confined here in an airplane because it's going to take so much real estate to turn. I said, no, just like crank it over to the left and pull and you'll be good. And you're like, oh, you can actually do that. And like, we don't realize what you can do in the other regime.
I remember, you know, my first few fixed wing lessons where, you know, you're on the runway and you're doing the takeoff roll and I'm just like, you know, gingerly putting the throttle in and it's about halfway in and we're about to take off. And like, it's not even full open. And I'm like, well, I guess you don't need it all the way in, but it was just so strange. You know, I'm so used to very, very small inputs of control all the time. And going back and forth between the two. And like George said, your brain kind of figures it out. So I don't really have any moments where I'm just like, confused at what's what.
Come on, how many times did you tell me in your first couple of flights you were reaching other for
than,
collective?
Yeah. Other than a few, yeah, a few instances I'll specify specifically. One was when I was doing initial instrument training and I was under the hood. So I had obviously no visual references outside. And I was low. I was like 50 feet low. And I was like reaching down on my left leg trying to find the collective and it wasn't there. And I ended up grabbing my Bose headset receiver and it like popped up from between the seat and the door. And I thought the collective had fallen out. Like I thought the duals were falling out and I was just freaking out because I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm, you know, the duals are out. And that was like a 5 second instance, but it felt like, you know, 5 minutes in my head of just pure panic of not knowing what was going on. And that's when I was really like, okay, this might be something.
So just to clarify, he was flying a 172 and reaching for the collective, which is kind of, let's simplify it for those that don't know. It's kind of if you took a throttle and an elevator and smashed them together in a helicopter.
Yeah, basically just a little bit of back pressure and a little bit of throttle would have done the trick. But at the time, my instinct was, you know, not to do that. So, you know, in times of stress, you're always going to go back to your like very default primacy moments. And that was one for me. And that was like eye opening at that time. And then the other stuff is the radio work. When I first started flying in planes, just being in that environment and different sight picture and different altitudes, slightly different instructions from ATC. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've almost said helicopter instead of Cessna and wanting to request a helicopter route into the airport or out of the airport, which, you know, isn't ideal. But those two things were pretty shocking to me at first.
George, what if Sam was mentioning the kind of control differences? What have you noticed training fixed wing guys coming over to helicopter? As kind of the big challenges initially to overcome?
Yeah, you know, a couple things, I guess.
learning the finesse is very clear. I think you saw that, Ryan, and it's very common. The push versus pull, if you will, in the event of engine failure, that can be a bad one as well as the rudder pedal use. Should I use some air quotes for you guys there? Rudder pedal use for adverse yaw that doesn't exist necessarily in a helicopter. One thing that Sam's comments made me think about, which keep this in mind, Ryan, but when I did my helicopter flight test, one of the comments was that in the unusual attitude, I recovered a little too abruptly, a little too quickly. And I have seen that in fixed-wing students subsequent as well. So it's sort of interesting to see if...
I have to add, because I did the exact opposite on my... on my recovery from a user attitude, I recovered too slowly.
Yeah. From a fixed wing guy going into helicopter, you know, we always trying to think like, why do we over control, you know, and in an airplane, when we slow down and we're getting into the landing regime or shortly after takeoff, obviously the less air we have going over the wings, the less effective the control surfaces are going to be. And we need to make a bigger aileron or bigger elevator movement for the reduced airflow to affect the change we want. So at cruise speed in a fixed wing airplane, it takes less input on the controls to achieve the desired result. And the slower we get, the more exaggerated the inputs get. So if you were to go onto YouTube and watch like a cockpit landing video in a 747, I mean, you swear those guys are almost going full deflection in every which way just to affect a small change. So the fixed wing guy in me, I'm going slow, therefore I must need more input. Whereas the helicopter's almost the opposite. It's the slower and lower you are to the ground, the less input you want to make. And I think that was a big thing for me, and a big switch moment when that kind of clicked, that I don't need to give more input when I'm slower.
The wing is still moving fast because it's that rotor right. Spinning over our heads. Yeah.
It's the other thing, another difference was, I remember, I know Sam's yelled at me for it. Maybe George, you did on our flight.
Oh, I don't yell.
But when you yell, it's... No, I know you don't. That's what I was going to say.
I yell?
No. Well, you did. On this one, you're kind of like, get your hands back on the controls. Because Sam, when you went to fixed wing, I said, if the airplane does something weird in fixed wing, almost the best thing you can do is just let go and just let it fix itself. Like, it'll eventually right itself with enough time and altitude, kind of, sort of, right? But we're coming into the airport to land, or, you know, just taken off, or we're like low level on the arrival route. And I mean, it's summer, it's hot out, and you know, there's like a bead of sweat, like going down my forehead, like about to drip into my eyeball. And I let go of either collective or cyclic to go like clear the sweat out of my eye. You're like, put your hand back on the, like, you can't let go. And I'm like, ah, and and like, this is another really big difference between the two that people might find interesting is, I mean, in an airplane, let's be honest, you could basically be on the takeoff roll or in the flare and be drinking your tea at the same time if you do it right, if everything's trimmed out. And I mean, they're inherently stable, and you can, I mean, you'll be sloppy, but you could fly with your feet on the floor in one hand, and you can do it. But in a helicopter, especially if you're in an arrival or departure phase or down low, every one of your appendages is doing something. Like, both your feet are on the pedals, on air quote, and they're sensitive as hell. You know, you got one hand on the cyclic, the other one on the collective. Like, everything is doing something, and you can't let go. So before you lift off, you need to make sure that you're in a comfortable seated position, that your feet are placed correctly, that you don't have an itch that you're going to need to scratch like 2 seconds later. And it has taught me so much body awareness. You know, you got that bead of sweat is going to drip into your eyeball. Just deal with it and land with the bead of sweat dropping into your eyeball. That's something that we don't have to do in fixed wing. I mean, would you guys agree?
Yeah. I mean, for sure. There's just every second counts in heli. Like, I mean, it's just milliseconds, you know? So it's such a different frame of mind, in my opinion, especially low level. You know, there's critical phases of flight and fixed wing as well. But in helicopter, it seems like you're very close to that critical phase a lot of the time, especially where the especially in the train and the environment that we fly in here in BC. We're always flying relatively close to terrain, and that's kind of how we fly in Canada. It's not like that in other parts of the world, but in Canada and helicopters specifically, you know, these are tools that are used because they're needed in Canada here. And that's a big difference as opposed to helicopters in the States. You know, a lot of the places that they need access to, they just build a road, and we don't have that ability here. So helicopters are truly, you know, utilized to their full potential here. And that's why I love flying in Canada so much. And it just makes sense. And that's really the key factor for, you know, helicopter operators in Canada.
George, do you want to maybe touch on, we're talking differences between fixed wing and heli, the difference in kind of spatial awareness and situational awareness in one versus the other?
Well, I was thinking as Sam was talking there, just with this current line of discussion, that helicopter flying very much needs to be subconscious. You know, as Sam says, we have seconds or milliseconds sometimes to make an adjustment or do something in order to do a good job of flying the helicopter. And that is true in fixed wing as well, but I think we all probably know that, like you said, you could take off a Cessna almost with your feet on the floor, certainly land it that way. And, you know, you can land a Cessna with just trim and power if you need to. And of course, there's been some significant accidents in our world that have shown that many pilots become button pushers and don't remember the basics of flying. You can't get away with that in the helicopter world. When I was a younger pilot, I sort of had this thought of aviation that if anybody had a dream of flying, they should pursue it. You know, just go take some lessons, try it out, because it's such a fabulous experience and opportunity that we have. When I started training in helicopters, I changed that opinion. I don't think that everybody should try to become a helicopter pilot. You know, most people can be trained, and I also hold the principle that often those that take longer to learn actually become better pilots in the end, because they have to work harder at understanding what they're learning and how to do it. But there's helicopter flying is inherently riskier, so some people probably shouldn't do it. You know, and of course there's a cost factor that discourages those that might need to take a really long time. So.
Speaking of time, I think it's kind of a natural way to talk about the time requirement to get a license. So one of you guys maybe want to cover if somebody went from never not having a pilot's license at all to heli versus having a fixed wing license and converting to heli, kind of the time difference. And then the other interesting thing here is in the fixed wing side, we go usually get a private license, time build, get your 200 hours minimum, and then get your commercial. In the heli world, you can go straight from zero to commercial and skip heli. In the heli world, you can go straight from zero to commercial and skip your private, which I didn't know until I showed up at the school, and I thought that was bonkers. But do you guys want to, one of you guys just touch on the requirements off the street and with the conversion?
Yeah, sure. So basically, as you mentioned, you can go straight CPL heli in Canada without ever holding a private license in any category. If you were to do that, it's a 100-hour commercial CPL minimum requirement. Of that 100 hours, 55 of it has to be dual and 35 of it has to be solo, which allows for 10 hours of flex time, basically, for other endorsements or possibly more solo time, more dual time, depending on your requirement. It's almost always dual, unless they're trying to do something very specific with that solo time. But that's tight. I mean, 100 hours is very tight, which makes the private requirement even more tight. So I believe the private requirement is 45 hours with a credit of 5, which could be in the sim, but I don't think that's a very realistic goal for helicopter at all. It's tight with it, without any experience previously, to be able to do that is something else. And if you are going to be flying privately, more than likely because of the inability to rent helicopters privately, it's more likely you're going to be an owner situation where you probably could afford and appreciate the additional training to get to the commercial level. And even at that level, even at that 100 hour level, there's still a lot that needs to be learned. And even thinking back to my time at 100, 200, 300, 500, 600, and you know, even now, coming up on 1500, like it's I learned something new every single day. And you can't never stop learning. And if you do, you're probably being complacent and you're going to learn something, whether you like it or not. So it's, and I totally agree with what George was saying earlier. Like I 100% believe that not everyone should be flying helicopters for sure. It's a very specific type of flying. It's a very, you know, by the seat of your pants kind of feel. There's just a lot of gray area on how to do things or how not to do things. And they can be overruled by, you know, so many different factors and feelings and even your gut. I mean, there's so many things that can change that gray area. And I feel in my fixed wing training now, it's a little bit more black and white. And I think in the IFR world, a little bit too. Obviously, there's still going to be situations where you're going to need to make adjustments and go with your gut. But in helicopters, it's just when you have a problem, you're not taking out a checklist to check what's going on. Like you're holding on for dear life and making split second decisions that are either going to save your life or not. And there's no time to reach for a checklist. And if you are reaching for a checklist, you're probably not, you know, doing the right thing because you don't have time.
I don't know what appendage I'd be reaching for a checklist with because both ends
exactly
of
busy. Exactly.
The only one left ain't grabbing a checklist.
You know, one comment that's in line with what Sam's saying there is I found when I first became a helicopter pilot that I call them straight line pilots now. And Ryan, you do sort of backcountry flying, so you probably won't suffer from this the way I did. But as a fixed wing pilot, you go to an airport, you got a runway, you got a windsock, you got a couple choices. You know, I land here, I land there. And we use our circuit very religiously to set ourselves up for the approach and landing. And one of the really cool things I found once I finally got used to it was how helicopters can do so many diverse versions of an approach. You know, we can have a, you know, 100-foot final if we need it. And you have to respect the limitations of that. You have to respect the limitations of your machine and not abuse those privileges, if you will. But the dynamic variations and freedom that you have with the helicopter are, well, they're a ton of fun, frankly. So
I want to finish off the training requirements. So it was a 45 for a private, 100 for a commercial. If you're converting a fixed wing, is it the same for private to heli and as is commercial fixed wing commercial to heli?
No. So commercial airplane to commercial helicopter is a 60-hour conversion.
60, yeah.
And then as far as going from the private airplane to private helicopter and vice versa, that's the same amount of credits to basically ultimately be 30 hours of flight time, which is very, very low, for the helicopter.
Okay, I wanted to tie that off because just people are going to be wondering if they wanted to convert. So 60-hour conversion to heli commercial, 100 hours to heli commercial off the street. And if you're going to do private, you might as well do commercial. So we'll just leave it at that for now.
In Canada, yes. In the States, it's totally different. But here in Canada, that's pretty much how it goes.
So things that translate across, I mean, the radio work, the principles of it translate across. The laws, the thing I found right away from our first lesson with both of you is the laws of aerodynamics are exactly the same. The application is just completely different. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah.
In like the laws of physics don't change, but how you apply them.
Yeah, essentially, yes. I mean, it's still lift and weight and thrust and drag.
I think a fixed wing pilot will come in with the advantage of being able to see an approach, see a glide path. That's helpful. A little bit of fixed wing knowledge I find is a bit helpful, like in an autorotative flare sort of thing, the round don't and that type of thing, depending on how you do them. Those are little benefits, I guess, that can cross over. But
have you ever trained somebody that is so stuck on, but in fixed wing we do it this way, but in fixed wing we do it that way, and it becomes a hindrance to their helicopter training, rather than just accepting the fact that it's different and I'm just going to have to change? Or do you find that the people that come into switching over to the other side are doing so with an open mind, knowing it's going to be different?
I've found that they gain a respect for the helicopter very quickly. Respectful fear, perhaps, and you know, respect mm-hmm. of the instruction that they're receiving, that I haven't had that problem, thankfully. So,
yeah, I would say, I would say it's the same for me. I mean, I think anyone who comes to the table with experience, they're obviously going to be a step ahead of anyone off the street with no experience, unless they're really into video games and VR. Because I've definitely had a few guys come off the street who've never hovered a helicopter before, but have spent a lot of time on video games and VR simulations and have been able to hover all three first try and actually land. Mm-hmm. And never flown a real helicopter before. So
that's crazy, because our first flight, I swear to God, I can land my airplane in less real estate than it took me to try and hover.
It's true. But yeah, it's you know, the experience helps, and the aerial awareness helps, radio communication helps, because it's just, it's workload, right? And when you first start in the helicopter, you're just so saturated. And that's the same thing that happened to me when I started flying in fixed wing. I was so oversaturated with the different controls and, you know, just the different dash layout and my scan and my attitudes and everything is, I don't know if this is a straight level or what the cruise power setting is or any of it. So
it's funny that you're talking about saturation of radio. Cause I mean, I talk on the radio for a living as a professional pilot. I know how to talk on the radio. As an air traffic controller, I sure as hell know how to talk on the radio. But when you gave me the push to talk and the helicopter at the same time, probably for the first like 7 or 8 hours, I could not do both. I can talk on the radio with my, like, asleep. I probably sleep talk in aviation phraseology, realistically. But I could not get a transmission off or even just hear them passing traffic and process that and the helicopter at the same time. It's not happening.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same thing that happened to me when my first few fixed wing flights. I'm hearing where people are, but I have no reference to like where they actually are. And I hear a helicopter on frequency and I'm like, what is that helicopter doing here? Like, I don't know where he's at and I can't see him. And I remember doing circuits in Chilliwack, probably around like 4 hours, 3 or 4 hours. And a Bell 47 came and landed at the fuel pumps and departed while I was doing circuits. And I never saw him ever. Versus if I was in any of our machines, I would have had laser beams on that guy the entire time. But I was so focused on keeping that thing down the center of that runway that I had no time to even think about looking out the side window or try to figure out where he's at. I'm just hopeful that he knows not to come near me. And now, knowing that, I now know why we have so much conflict out in the practice area with, you know, Cessna's not making calls or helicopters not making calls and vice versa, because it's two different worlds. And they are, you know, the helicopters always operate mostly very low level in respect to the planes. So looking down at the earth it's very hard to see. The rotors help a little bit because they kind of break up that light and that makes it a little bit easier to see. But whenever you're trying to spot traffic from above, looking down at the ground, it's so much harder than up at the sky. And we have such good visibility out of the helicopters in comparison. Like, we can see almost everything.
We can see way better. And I usually warn all of my students that when they hear a radio call, they need to, you know, it's a good idea to kind of consider which way the guy's going, because if they say they're over the greenhouse, usually they're a mile or two before the greenhouse, because that's when they can actually see it out the window.
Yeah, that's a really good point too, because I'm looking at call out points and I can't see underneath me, so I have no idea where I am. But that is true.
You know what started scaring me more than anything when it comes to traffic calls in the helicopter is the realization that I could actually get hit from behind. It's something I never really thought about. Airplanes are all about the same speed, you know. They're either going to be coming from the side or from the front. And in the helicopter, we're sitting there, you know, trucking along, and I hear an airplane, you know, I'm over such and such eastbound. And I'm like, well, I'm eastbound. They're behind me. And if they don't see me, they could actually run me over. Well,
yeah,
especially
and
you,
one of the worst things is, is seeing a shadow. Seeing a shadow cross near your vicinity in a farmer's field or anywhere is one of the most terrifying experiences, because you know they're in your vicinity, and the shadows, man, those freak me out.
I think we should just make a deal amongst the community that us helicopters will stay low and airplanes can stay high. Maybe, you know, helicopters 1,000 and below, airplanes 2,000 and above. Ryan's going to disagree with that.
I want an exception to yellowtail jaggers.
Fair enough.
Yeah. The sandbars are hopping with some heli action, that's for sure.
Yeah. Another difference, so when you get your fixed wing license, private or commercial, it's a blanket license that covers initially all, you know, single engine non-high performance airplanes. So in theory, your private license covers you for all the Cessnas, all the Pipers, you know, even your Bonanza, tailwheel, whatever. Helicopter's different. George, you want to just talk about the privileges you get when you get your initial license in terms of type?
Yeah, so every different helicopter type in Canada is type specific. I think it's different in the US. Maybe Sam would know about that. But essentially in Canada, there's a few types that cross over if they're similar enough. For example, a Bell Jet Ranger and the Long Ranger lines are the same type rating. Likewise, an A-Star also crosses over to an EC-130, which is, a Fenestron machine, even though it has a similar engine and rotor system. So essentially, any new helicopter that you wish to fly requires training and sign-off for a type rating. I'm doing one of those right now for an R-66 for a student. So
what's involved in... So let's say I do the Cabri with Sam, and then I was going to come fly your R-44. And I've done all my training and my commercial license on the Cabri, so I've got a Cabri commercial license with a Cabri type. What do I have to do to, let's say, get an R-44 added on there? What's the process?
One thing to point out initially is that you don't actually have to do that with a flight instructor. I would highly recommend it, but a commercial pilot can sign your recommendation for a type rating on a different type of helicopter. The essence of a type rating is that you need to show proficiency in essentially all flight test items, probably more similar to a PPC in that, you know, navigation and instrument isn't necessary, but we want to see proficiency in all emergencies and general handling and knowledge of all limitations and procedures for that particular helicopter.
So it's not a Transport Canada flight test. It's not, you have to go to flight safety. It's basically having another commercial pilot at the minimum, but preferably a flight instructor sign off that you're proficient. And then they actually put that on your license. It's printed on your license.
Yes, that's right. So an authorized person, if they fill out the application correctly, can sign your license such that you can walk out of that office and legally fly that new aircraft. And your written type rating is good for 90 days, like anything else written in your license. And you'll receive this sticker in the mail that you insert into your pilot book.
Oh, it could get really expensive. It's like a really expensive, like brownie sash where you're collecting badges. Like, I can start a fire. I can build a shelter. And this seems like a very expensive possible collection of different helicopter types.
Very much so, yeah.
I don't know. Do you guys have any, like, funny training stories? I've got one or two already from the 16 hours I've done with you guys. But, I don't know, just something that somebody may find entertaining. Maybe Sam, you going over to fixed wing, and George, maybe something you've seen somebody come over and do in the heli.
I have a bit of a story. It's a little more on the serious side, but it relates back to actually what you were talking about being sort of really gentle with helicopters and more, more forceful is not really the right word, but, you know, larger inputs or such with fixed wing. We might have to explain what this is, but I know a lot of people sort of know me as one of the only guys that they know that's actually been in LTE. And you guys probably both know what that is, but it's loss of tail rotor effectiveness, and it affects some helicopters more than others, which basically means that the tail rotor has insufficient thrust to counteract the torque that the engine's inputting to the main rotor system. And it results in an uncontrolled spin. In a North American helicopter, it would be a right yaw, right spin, and in the Cabri, it'd be left, I guess. And it was during my training, and I was flying. So when I was a ab initio training student, sometime in the, I would guess I had about 75 hours, and I was doing some mountain training with a very experienced instructor who's since passed away, but hugely experienced guy. And I was doing a recce on a mountaintop in the Jet Ranger. It was Jet Ranger 2, which has a smaller tail rotor. And he was busy snapping pictures with his camera, which maybe wasn't such a good thing. And I was going along one side of the hill trying to feel the wind, which is very difficult, particularly as a new student. And the helicopter was probably slowing a little bit. We have trouble sensing that also as low-time pilots. A little bit of a right yaw started to happen, and I was thinking about what, you know, another instructor had told me, that, you know, you can usually just sort of fly out of it. I was trying to be really gentle with the Jet Ranger turbines in particular, like to be treated gently. Tried to fly out a little bit, and I had more left pedal. I just wasn't using it. And, you know, I was under this idea that I, you know, needed to be super gentle on the machine. We ended up spinning around three times probably on the top of that mountain, about 100 feet above it. And instructor dropped his camera and did a few things, and we flew onto there. And that's as close as I've come to crashing. And probably one of the, you know, very strong memory for me. Unfortunately, my young son was sitting in the back seat as well, which wasn't a great thing and was a bit of a shake-up moment for sure. But it certainly helps build your respect of helicopters, what they can do, and how you do need to be deliberate and command that aircraft when it needs it.
For the fixed wing guys, the LTE, or what George is referring to there, is aerodynamically completely different, but think of it as basically the equivalent of your base to final turn stall spin. It's kind of that severity. It's the thing that everyone dreads and everybody does everything to avoid. It's basically the helicopter version of that in terms of the pucker factor, I think, would be a fair comparison.
And that's like very relatable for the Cabri because of the Fenestron tail rotor, a very high percentage of Cabri accidents have been related to loss of tail rotor effectiveness, essentially, and not correcting for the yaw. And the Cabri requires a ton of right pedal in comparison to a traditional helicopter with a traditional tail rotor, whether it's right or left pedal. It's a very large amount, and the amount of pedal that you have to push is very surprising when you're not used to pushing that much pedal. So when I find that students, when they transition from like a Cabri to an R44, which has a very effective tail rotor, they end up over controlling the the tail rotor on the 44 quite a lot because they're used to the very spongy nature and large application of pedal that's required in the Cabri to maintain directional control. And it's just not the same in the 44. And you end up really punching that pedal in and getting that the tail wagging back and forth, and it causes the whole helicopter to start penduluming pretty aggressively. But one thing's for sure, the Cabri has the thrust to compensate for the torque if you push the pedal all the way, which is the key term. Like, you have to push that pedal full to the stop. You can't stop. But if the spin or the torque has developed and you're already in the spin, there's nothing you can do to combat that. Even with full right pedal applied, you're going to have to reduce that torque, which is going to require you to reduce some collective, which is going to cause you to reduce your height. And if that happens close to the ground, that's where the accidents can occur. And there's a really, really upsetting video of a Cabri coming into land that starts a left yaw and loses it and ends up coming in contact with a plane and then a hangar. And luckily the student survived, but it's a very dangerous condition, and you have to be so laser sharp on those pedals to ensure that directional control is maintained. Because once it starts to go, like George said, it's a lot to recover it. And for a young pilot, it's not there. You're spinning so quickly and it snaps you around so fast that you really have no idea what's going on. And your only instinct is to pull up on the collective. And that's the last thing that you
want. It's going to make it worse. It's very much like ground looping a tail draggery, Ryan.
I haven't done it, knock on wood.
But it's about minimizing the yaw, so that you have much more experience with tail draggers than I do.
I think that helicopter, if you were to compare helicopter flying to fixed wing flying, I think flying tailwheel is probably the best preparation you could have to go into a helicopter, just because of how active your feet have to be and how you're constantly in preventative mode. That's what I feel helicopter flying is you're not so much flying it as you're preventing it from doing something bad, which in turn ends up being you're flying it. Sam and I, after I don't know how many hours, like maybe 7 or 8, we're up at like Stave River, you know, taking off and landing on the gravel bars, and I started getting a little bit cocky and I kind of went by a spot. I'm like, I'm just going to swing around to the left and go there. And I mean, I've seen helicopters in movies, you know, they just kind of like pivot on the spot, and here I am, I start adding power, and then I put in left pedal, which is not great, and the thing just snapped on me, and I let out a squealy holy F-bomb. I thought we were going to die. And Sam, he saw it coming, and, you know, to his credit as an instructor, and I do this with clients fixed wing, you know, you let them kind of go as far as you can let them go. He saw it coming and decided, instead of saying, you can't do that, he let it happen. And it's one of those lessons the hard way. I will never do that, or try to never do that again. That scared the shit out of me.
Yeah, and that's something that's so important in the Cabri. And it's something that we do now, because it is fixable, but you have to, prevention is the key.
Yeah, it was the closest I felt to dying in a flying machine, I think, ever was right then. Another funny one was, I think, we're, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours in, and we're doing circuits to the dike, and we're just kind of like intro to like taking off and landing. It was like maybe the second or third landing you were letting me do, and I felt like my eye for the glide path to the landing spot's pretty good doing fixed wing stuff and doing the off airport stuff. Like, I can sense all that. And I guess with helicopters, you start out, you get there, and then you know you're supposed to stop and get into like a little bit of a hover and then kind of pick your spot and put it on. And I come in, and the approach was pretty good, and I felt good. Like, I'm going to end up right at the spot that I want to. Like, it's like a glide path ILS right to a spot, and we're bang on. I'm like, all right, this is looking really good. And we just got to the bottom end, and I just like basically just flared and set it down. And Sam goes, you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. And I thought like something bad was about to happen. And I go, what? He goes, that was a no hover landing. And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, well, no, that's at like the end of the syllabus. Like, we do hover landings and then we work up to no hover landings. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. He's like, no, it's harder. I said, I've been flying for 20 years. Every landing I've ever done has been a no hover landing. Because I can't hover in a freaking airplane. And he's like, oh yeah, it kind of makes sense. So maybe we need to work this backwards. But
it was a good no hover landing. It was really good on the dike, no less.
You know what? I walked away. I'm like, yeah, I looked into that. That was good. But I think we could talk about this stuff all night. Helicopters are freaking awesome. I feel like I have refound my passion for aviation. I feel like it might have ruined my fixed wing flying.
It'll help it in the end.
No. Like ruined it as in it will never be as fun as it was before.
Right. True. Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, Ryan. True.
George, I want to end with you real quick. So you fly so many different types, but you also fly a Piaggio, which not a lot of people get to fly. What's flying the Piaggio like?
It's a lot of fun. And again, I couldn't help but think about that when we were talking about traffic avoidance, because when that thing departs the runway, I can't see anything in front of me. So good thing it's IFR, good thing it climbs fast. On approach and landing, once it's configured, I can see fairly well, but I can't fly any slower than 120 knots. So that's a bit tricky sometimes, but I do admire the, it's based in Boundary Bay and those controllers there, I give them props for fitting us in, because that's quite something. I know I was out with a friend of ours, Ryan, doing some currency circuits in Abbotsford a year or two ago, and we were on final at 120 knots behind a Cessna, and yeah, there was just no way we were going to make that work. So we got an extra circuit in, of course. So it's a fun plane, very capable. It certainly will bite you on the ground if you're not good with it. Amazing plane to fly. It's too bad there isn't more of them out there. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a Piaggio 180. If you don't know it, look it up. It's some people think it's the most gorgeous machine they've ever seen. And other people think it's the most hideous machine they've ever seen. It kind of depends who you ask. I think it's pretty neat myself.
The fastest twin-engine turboprop civilian aircraft in the world. And yeah, some very neat aerodynamics there.
Okay, so, and I want to end with this because we've got three, I mean, I'm not licensed helicopter yet, but we're working our way there. I want to go with, if you could fly any fixed-wing airplane and any helicopter, if you had like a hangar and you could have one fixed wing airplane and one helicopter, what would be in the hangar?
Well, I certainly enjoy the Piaggio right now. I think there might be a reason for that to change in the future. You never know, but that's a pretty awesome bird that I feel very lucky to fly. Helicopter wise, that's an interesting question, because I often think
anything. What
is my favorite helicopter? And the answer is always whatever I'm flying. I know that probably sounds like a bit of a lame answer, but it's true. If I'm in a Bell 47, 44, 66, 120, whatever the case, Bell 505, I'm pretty happy in whatever helicopter I'm flying at the time. So.
All right, I'll let you cop out. That's fine.
Yeah, it is a cop out, I know.
What about you, Sam? I know your helicopter one, but go for it.
Yeah, well, I think you got me hooked on the TBM. I think I'd have to go with the TBM. I would love to get my hands on one of those one day. So we'll see how far my fixed wing stuff goes. But as far as helicopters go, there's definitely a few. But I think obviously the A-Star B3, but probably, the AS-365 Dolphin, that one. Talon's got a pretty sweet one that I got to go check out, and they just got that thing approved for night vision goggle firefighting. So that's a helicopter my mom flew in for Life Flight. So I'd have to fly that helicopter one
day. I'm going to say it again. So, if you want to hear that full story, which you do need to hear, go to the Pilot to Pilot podcast and find Sam's episode. You will not regret spending another hour listening to podcasts. I promise. Cool. Okay, and mine, fixed wing, I have to stay loyal to the TBM. It's TBM every time, just because it's awesome. And helicopter, Sam, you've got me on this A-Star thing, because we went and spent that the night in hanging out with Justin in the hangar, checking out his, and that was a pretty sweet rig. I really like the H-60 Blackhawk, though, just as a machine, and just kind of heavy lift and just the sound and the look. And I think I'd have to go Blackhawk if nothing mattered and I could just fly anything from my little knowledge of helicopters, that's my little toy.
I'm pretty sure they have auto pedals in that Perfect. Thing, so should be good oh. for you.
And with a dig, that's fine. All right, guys, I really thank you for spending an hour with me. I really appreciate both your time. I really appreciate both your guidance. George, we flew once, but you know, we've kept in touch, and you've you know, also been a guide for me, and it's cool getting out and chatting on the radio, you know, flying by you and your student on the ridge side there with the Bearhawk, and just catching up, because we are all a community, and it's neat that we can all be friends and stay close regardless of what school we work at or what school we're a student at, or in Sam's case, he's, you know, playing for both teams, but yeah, thank you guys so much for your time. And Sam, thank you for talking me into an intro flight and for being an awesome instructor and becoming a great friend as well. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, man. I'm enjoying the time together and looking forward to continuing the training and seeing what we can do with it.
Very good. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate this. And thanks for all you're doing in terms of promoting safety and continued learning. It's really good for the community.
Thanks, George. I appreciate that. All right, there you have it. Our conversation with both Sam Adams and George. And once again, I've set a time record. These keep getting longer and longer, but I don't want to cut good stuff short, especially when we've got such awesome aviators to learn from. And I think we all take stuff away from this. So I'm going to close it off by just once again letting you know that we love your feedback. Go ahead and contact us. info@cardinalaviation.ca. Visit us online, find out more about our services, www.cardinalaviation.ca. Check us out on Instagram @cardinalaviation. And if you like what you hear and you want to support this content, you can find out how to do that on the website. All right, everybody. Thanks again. Until next time, fly safely, never stop learning, and take care of yourself.